From 91.3 WYSO in Yellow Springs, Ohio, you're listening to a special presentation of speeches from the 2012 Dayton Literary Peace Prize.
We're honoring, in a way, a desire for common sense, to pay attention to those important questions of what we die for and what we kill for, if anything.
This hour, you'll hear authors from around the world talking about writing and peace.
Somehow, those voices transformed from words of war and hardship into a desire, in this boy at least, to hear them and transform them into words that bend towards peace.
Coming up, the winners of the 2012 Dayton Literary Peace Prize, Adam Hochschild, Andrew Krivak, and Tim O'Brien, winner of this year's Richard C. Holbrook Award for Distinguished Achievement. That's right after this news. Welcome to a special presentation of the 2012 Dayton Literary Peace Prize Award Ceremony. From 91.3 WYSO, I'm Juliet Frumholt. For the next hour, we'll hear from authors who have been honored for advancing peace through literature. The Dayton Peace Accords ended the war in Bosnia in 1995, and the Dayton Literary Peace Prize was created as a response 11 years later. It's the only international literary peace prize in the United States and honors authors from around the world for fiction, nonfiction, and lifetime achievement. This year's event was held on Veterans Day, also known as Armistice Day, which marks the end of World War I. The 2012 nonfiction runner-up is Anya Cizadlo for her book Day of Honey. And this year's winner is Adam Hochschild's To End All Wars, a history of World War I and its effects on both soldiers on the battlefield and pacifists on the home front in England. Hochschild was introduced by 2011 nonfiction award recipient Wilbert Rideau.
Adam is a journalist who writes books that sometimes takes us into historical arenas we would rather not enter to show us realities we need to know. I am no fan of war, or war movies, or war histories, but I love this book. There is a saying, sometimes attributed to Winston Churchill, that history is written by the victors. But what Adam does, like any first-rate journalist, is to go dig up the rest of the story. He fleshes out the complicated world he portrays, drawing upon pamphlets, letters, and diaries of those marginalized, drowned out, or forgotten over time. He prompts in us deep questions about the morality and glory of war. He takes us to the Western Front, where war has come to this: cats are nesting in the corpses of British soldiers in the stinking, overcrowded trenches. He takes us to the battlefield at the Somme, where the commander knowingly sends waves of helpless soldiers to be mowed down by German machine gun fire. 19,000 men killed just the first day. We learn the perverse result of this slaughter is that British generals began to measure their success not by territory gained, but by their own casualties, which numbered 500,000 in less than 5 months. And then we learned that the British government co-opted the press with VIP quarters and red carpet treatment. Most importantly, Adam Hochschild takes us into the other trenches on the home front to give us the perspective of those who passionately defied the popular cry for war, writers like Bertrand Russell and pacifist leaders Charlotte Despard and Sylvia Pankhurst, all of whom had staunch, active pro-war relatives, a cousin, a brother, a sister, and mother. We see the devastation of families torn apart by war, and it's hard not to think of our own civil war. Adam vividly portrays the courage it took to resist the draft and to speak out against the war, and the high price conscientious objectors and resistors paid. 6,000 were sentenced to hard labor in prison, where they lived in 7 by 12 foot cells. Other resistors were sent in handcuffs to the trenches on pain of death if they refused to fight. Why such draconian measures? Perhaps, as government lawyer Sir Archibald Botkin is quoted as saying, "War will become impossible if all men were to have the view that war is wrong." To end all wars leaves the reader with questions. What is the essential nature of war, of human beings? Are we forever doomed to be fodder for those driven by notions of military glory, by greed, vanity, arrogance, or revenge? Or can we share the vision of one conscientious objector, quoted in this remarkable book, who called his belief in peace, quote, "a truth which the world as yet had not grasped, but which it would one day treasure as its most precious inheritance"? I'm extremely honored to present the 2012 Dayton International Literary Peace Prize for Nonfiction to Adam Hochschild. Where are you, Adam?
As a reporter, I've encountered a certain amount of conflict and war directly, but I prefer writing about history because sometimes I think that when we look at events far back in the past, or not so far back in the past, but removed from the time that we're living in right now, we can see things a little bit more clearly. And I have long been fascinated by the First World War, because it seems to me in so many ways such a monument to so many dimensions of human folly. The nations of Europe had all been getting along with each other rather well, and then they fell into unprecedented destruction through an odd chain of events that began in late June 1914 with the assassination of the Austrian Archduke at Sarajevo. Even 4 weeks later, the end of July 1914, the continent was still at peace. But less than a month later, the war that broke out was so immensely destructive of human life that in August of that year, in a single country, France, more than 23,000 French soldiers were killed in one single day of fighting. And death tolls like that recurred again and again and again throughout the war until by the time it ended, there were more than 9 million soldiers dead and probably, though we'll never know the exact figure, an even larger number of civilians. Something I find haunting about this war when we look back on it, when, as I say, we can see it a little more clearly, is that it was clearly based on a number of illusions. Two of them seem paramount to me. One was that on both sides, everybody thought the war would be won quickly and easily. The second illusion was that winning the war would resolve certain crucial questions, the main one being, who was going to be boss in Europe? Almost nobody anticipated the long time that the war would last, nearly 4.5 years, the vast number of deaths, the way this war remade the world in every conceivable way for the worse, and of course the way it laid the groundwork for the rise of Hitler and the coming of a second, even more deadly and even more destructive world war. In closing, I would say this. Historians like to write about things not just because they're inherently interesting or important, but because sometimes there are echoes in these events for today. And I would suggest that those illusions about the First World War that I just mentioned are still very much with us today. The illusion that when we start a war, it's going to be over with quickly and easily. You remember the image of President Bush landing on that aircraft carrier in 2003 in front of that big banner that said, "Mission accomplished." A lot of us are still not sure what the mission was or whether it's been accomplished. And the second illusion is that jumping into war will solve a problem rather than create additional problems and complications that nobody can quite imagine. I think those illusions lay behind the wars in Afghanistan and Iraq, just as they lay behind the war of 1914, 1918. And they also lie behind the war that some people would like to start with Iran. So history has lessons for us, and we need to listen hard to hear them. One of those lessons was put very succinctly into words by a great military man, General Omar Bradley, who once said, "We know more about war than we know about peace." Thank you.
That was Adam Hochschild, author of To End All Wars, which won the 2012 Dayton Literary Peace Prize for nonfiction. You're listening to a special presentation of speeches from the Dayton Literary Peace Prize Awards Ceremony held on November 11, 2012 at the Schuster Center in Dayton, Ohio. This year's winning fiction book, Andrew Krivak's The Sojourn, also deals with World War I. Krivak was introduced by 2010 Fiction Award winner Marlon James, who also acknowledged runner-up Ha Jin, author of Nanjing Requiem.
I was really honored to acknowledge the winner and the runner-up for the fiction prize this year, because both are books that I'm a huge fan of. And for all sorts of... it's funny reading them together and seeing the many ways in which they sort of circle around the same theme, the same sort of... Both are in a lot of ways, driftless books. And both have this sort of indomitable human spirit, which I was really, really inspired by. And when I was thinking of writing this, I thought of flowers, of like a sea of poppies, like the Amitav Ghosh book. Poppies, red flowers going on for miles and miles and miles. And every now and then there's a spot of a green flower, a green plant. And the green isn't there to remind you of the greenness of green. The green is there to remind you of the redness of red. And I thought of that because war and conflict is so commonplace that sometimes we take it for granted, this absence of peace. That sometimes we have become so desensitized to a bad thing that we either realize it's, we either think it's a good thing or nothing at all. And one of the great things about this prize and about these books is that sort of spot of green in all that sea of red to remind you of the redness of red. And it's a question that's always raised at events like these, and it was raised last night. Can books that refuse to flinch from war, cruelty, inhumanity, even atrocity further the cause of peace? And the question is valid, but it can sometimes make a dangerous assumption that we know war and that we can see storms coming and that the truth is most of us don't. And those that do sometimes mistake forgetting for healing. We fall into the danger of the single story, the myth-making. When I was growing up, all I knew from about the Vietnam War is what I saw in the film The Green Berets. And I kept wondering, where in World War II was Vietnam? Because of how the film is structured. Talk about atrocities. The first real tool we have in bringing about peace, I think, is confronting war, is speaking truth to power, is recognizing conflict and inhumanity and cruelty, and to stare unblinkingly, to stare without blinking at things that most of us would rather look away from. In the citation by the Dayton Literary Prize judges, Andrew Krivak's debut novel, The Sojourn, has been compared to Tolstoy. And what do we talk about when we talk about Tolstoy? Heft? Sprawl? Not really. Tolstoy perfected is the death of Ivan Ilyich, because that is where he understands something that abounds in Andrew Krivak's novel. And the truth is this: of all the tools a writer can wield, the most devastating is economy. The Sojourn is charged with emotion, yet governed by restraint. It's densely populated, yet frighteningly intimate. A novel full of momentum, yet possessed with both a gift for observation and something you don't see too often in fiction these days, grace. A novel that shifts from Colorado to Austro-Hungary and Italian Alps with characters that never truly stop drifting. A war story about the futility of war. A voyage and a return to places you can never really return to. And the kind of light of hope that can only come through facing even your own heart of darkness. The novel is also an inquiry. What is this thing we call the human spirit? Why is it so indomitable? Where does it come from? And why does it linger even after death? And how can we all learn from it? Because if we're going to find the best that's in us, the part that encourages and lives in a world of peace, the part that can make that a living thing, then that spirit is where we're going to have to start. And books like The Sojourn show us a how. So, ladies and gentlemen, it's my great pleasure to introduce the 2012 winner of the Dayton Literary Peace Prize for The Sojourn, Andrew Krivak.
When I was a boy, I had a dog named Troy. He was a black lab and a collie mix. His arrival at our house in Dallas, Pennsylvania, which is just about 8 miles west of Wilkes-Barre, during a December snowstorm when I was two, is one of my first memories. He was supposed to have been named Thor, but the story goes that I couldn't get my mouth around the TH. So my older brothers agreed to change his name. And Troy, true to the myth, grew to be a fighter, fast and sleek and muscular, against every attempt my father made to tie him up, to rein him in, to break his spirit and teach him to obey, which in the end proved to be his undoing. Dogs, that is, not my father's. Discipline was my father's craft, and he taught me well. But Troy, I realized years later when I began to read fiction in college, Troy was like the dog named Lion in Faulkner's The Bear, fearless, resilient, loyal, determined to overpower, and all because he could not be taught to obey. He'd get scared, but he was never afraid. I mentioned Troy because it was past this dog, past his house, his dog house that we kept in our backyard, Troy on the leash that stretched to its bitter end so that he could push his cold, wet nose into my hand, that I walked on my way from the house in which I grew up to my grandmother's house, my mother's mother's house, who had been born in America but emigrated to Austria-Hungary before the Great War. There was a path worn past Troy through a stretch of woods up the next street and into my grandmother's kitchen that seemed merely an extension in my mind of my mother's own kitchen. And it was there at that table next to a wood stove where I sat with my younger brother and listened to the stories of a hard life in a hard land, the hunger, the survival, the meanness, the war, always told with a distant sadness on her face. And yet in the rising and falling tones of the beautiful Slovak she spoke, most of which my mother had to translate for us so that she too moved to the sadness of her own mother. I didn't consider the origin or the purpose of those stories then. They were exotic on one level, a kind of Slovak Arabian Nights, and understandable on another, as my brother and I came to know firsthand what it meant to stand up for each other in a place where fighting came with the territory. But regardless, I listened and let those stories find a way in because I loved and I trusted the teller. But when I moved from the world of stories told to books that I could pick up and read on my own, I understood what my grandmother was doing for herself in the constant telling and retelling of those stories, trying to come to peace with the fact that she had survived. And all of those tellings were in some way a kind of unburdening and an embrace of belief. She had disobeyed what fate had fallen to others. She had unleashed herself from a world that sought to break her spirit. She had been given something, a life, another soul who loved her, a chance to love children, a freedom in a land to which she had been born, and yet all her adult life lived almost as a stranger. And she told me those stories not to entertain her wide-eyed grandsons, but to remind herself of what she had been given, and perhaps to test daily her own personal question, a question we all ask at some point. Is it enough? Is it worthy what I have made? And when we walked back home from my grandmother's house on those days, past Troy the dog, who would bound up to us on his leash when he saw us coming out of the woods on that path and push his nose again into my hand, I wanted to set him loose, to unclip the nylon rope from his collar and let him run free. Maybe, I thought, maybe this time he'd see. He would see and he would stay, not give up so much as lay down that need in him to fight. And I tell you, there were dogs in our neighborhood who bore his scars, but he never bit another person and became docile around children. But he would find the porch, I imagined, and sit there like some benign lord who no longer had anything to prove, waiting, unfettered, unbound, but it wasn't to be. He got away on his own one day, and before any one of us could get to him, he was put down. This novel that I've written, The Sojourn, to which you've given this powerfully humbling prize, for which I'm so grateful, began as I listened to those stories of life in a strange land, lived by a man, my grandfather, whom I never knew, and a woman whose survival meant the possibility of my own. And as a result, I wondered to myself if I might unleash an imaginative world wherein I would find nothing impossible or bound. In another time, in another place, I could tell you where and how each of those stories that make up the fictional life of Joseph Vinich bend back into something I heard or imagined around that stove in Dallas, Pennsylvania, when I was a boy with a dog so aptly named Troy. But tonight it's enough to say that somehow those voices transformed from words of war and hardship there at the table, spread out like bread and wine, into a desire, in this boy at least, to hear them and transform them into words that bend towards peace. And so I want to dedicate this award to those who shaped me, to John and Elizabeth, who passed away a long, long time ago, and to my father, Thomas, who gave me discipline and freedom in the end, and my mother, Irene, she to whom I dedicated the sojourn and whose name means peace, passed away this May, and I miss talking to her. They've all done their work. They've all found their peace. What remains is for us to keep telling of it as well as to keep praying for it, to keep insisting upon it as well as to keep hoping for it, and to keep listening so that we'll know when to act, whether it's out in the world, Beirut, Iraq, Louisiana, or at work on a sentence, alone in a room with words. So to each and every one of you, please accept my deepest gratitude for this prize and all of the kind words you've said to me about this story that I've fashioned out of stories. And may God bless the labor of your hands. Thank you.
Andrew Krivak, winner of the 2012 Dayton Literary Peace Prize for Fiction for his book, The Sojourn. The Richard C. Holbrooke Distinguished Achievement Award honors writers whose body of work is about or connected to the idea of peace. The 2012 recipient is Tim O'Brien. He's a Vietnam veteran and journalist whose work captures the horrors of war while trying to understand its effect on the lands and people who participate willingly or unwillingly. O'Brien is best known for his 1973 memoir, If I Die in a Combat Zone, Box Me Up and Ship Me Home, and his 1990 story collection, The Things They Carried. Maureen White, who worked with Ambassador Holbrooke and now works as a senior advisor on humanitarian issues in Afghanistan and Pakistan, introduces Tim O'Brien.
I can't know that Richard Holbrooke had read Tim O'Brien's work, yet I am certain that he did. I am equally certain that he loved it, but more on that shortly. I am here because Richard was one of my closest friends and the truest of friends for 25 years. I also had the great good fortune of working for him twice in my life. First, in the second Clinton administration, when he was our ambassador to the United Nations, I was representing the U.S. government at the United Nations Children's Fund, UNICEF. And the second time was in his final assignment as the U.S. Special Representative for Afghanistan and Pakistan. He asked me, in the summer of 2009, when the Pakistani military had moved into the Swat Valley to try to extricate the Taliban's grip on that population, 2.6 million people fled the Swat Valley to escape the fighting. Richard called me and said, "I don't have anybody handling these issues for me in my office. I need you, and will you come down?" And I did, and I worked for him for the next year and a half on humanitarian issues in Afghanistan and Pakistan, dealing with refugees and those who are internally displaced by conflict and natural disaster. Some people might be surprised when I say this, but given his reputation, but working for Richard Holbrooke was a joy. He was, in fact, the best boss that I ever had. He was notorious for demanding a lot from his staff, but he never demanded more of us than he demanded of himself. And for all that he asked of us, he gave us more, so much more, in terms of loyalty and learning, of lessons in history and lessons in life. He had a terrible sense of the urgency about the work he was doing, and it was infectious. You felt you were part of something great and ached to work your hardest. One of my colleagues said after Richard died, "Now who will make me do my best?" As in all things, he had a voracious appetite. Richard's cultural appetite was equally large. He loved film and art and literature. The last book that Richard was reading before he died was Rudyard Kipling's Kim, which was actually set in Afghanistan. He loved essayists like George Orwell and Lionel Trilling, who he so often quoted, and poetry. His own book, To End a War, on the Bosnia Peace Accords, is punctuated with quotes from his beloved W.H. Auden. Tim O'Brien's writing is all of what Richard would have admired, not just because it is beautiful, vivid, and evocative, but because it conveys the horror of war in shockingly visceral language. And it does so through the haunted stories of soldiers. Soldiers whose stories end up haunting us long after we have laid the book down. And he would have loved it because it was about Vietnam. Of course, Vietnam was the crucible which shaped and sharpened Richard's diplomatic frame. His own hatred of war and his lifelong search of ways to prevent war and to end war started there. Richard Holbrooke entered the Foreign Service a few weeks after college graduation, and a year later he began 6 years of service in and on Vietnam, serving first in the Mekong Delta, then moving to the U.S. Embassy in Saigon, where he became a staff assistant to Ambassador Maxwell Terrell and Henry Cabot Lodge. In 1968, at the age of 27, Richard Holbrooke was asked to be a part of the American delegation to the Paris peace talks. Richard was no ordinary diplomat. He was a dirt under your fingernails kind of diplomat. He needed to be in the field, close to the war, to talk to the soldiers, to listen to people. He craved the tactile intensity of experiencing, even touching the anguish of it all. I know from the stories he told and others told about him, they plunged into the deep and dangerous to understand the dark underbelly of war and human suffering. And that is the essence of Tim O'Brien's writing. It takes us to that ugly place. It is unsparing in its search for the harsh details that tell us the terrible truths. To quote Tim O'Brien himself, "You can tell a true war story by its absolute, uncompromising allegiance to obscenity and evil." That is a real triumph of his writing. It is a body of work that consists not of one or two books, some of which you may have known or may have read, the things they carried with him. When I die, box me up and send me home. Going after Cacciato and several more. It is a body of work that has deftly delineated characters and broken new bonds in literary traditions because it mixes memories and paranoias. It mixes mysteries and fears. It mixes ugliness with the kindness of people struggling with the worst of life. It is a body of work that is noble because it addresses the ugliness of war with sparse truth. I was glad that giving this award brought me the occasion to read these books again. I read the beautiful, the things they carried, and I wish so that Richard was there. He and I would have shared a long, intense discussion of Tim O'Brien. Richard would have had a dog-eared copy and turned to passages he liked to read and read them aloud. Oh, what he would have had to say about this book, and oh, what I would have learned. And now I would like to welcome Tim O'Brien.
I don't want to begin my remarks tonight by talking about Vietnam. I want to begin in the here and now. I am 66 years old, and I am the proud father of my first children, a young boy named Tad, who's now sleeping over here in a tuxedo. He's 7 years old, and an older kid who's just barely awake named Timmy. And I want to begin with an anecdote about these kids. A couple of years back, I caught the younger kid, Tad, in our bathroom of our house, peeing into a wastebasket. And not just a wastebasket, but a wire mesh wastebasket. And not just a wire mesh wastebasket, but a wire mesh wastebasket situated on top of a fairly new maroon carpet that we had laid in the house. Well, I was astonished. The kid knew better. And I said to him, "Why are you doing this?" And I'm ordinarily a pretty quiet guy with my kids, but there was a certain earnestness in my voice. And it paralyzed Tad. He turned back toward the toilet, but made it only halfway. And finished the job midway between. Over and over, I said to Tad, "Why are you doing this? Why are you doing this?" And my wife heard me, Meredith, and she came scampering in, and she took charge of the disciplining duties. I retreated to my study, where I kind of muttered to myself for an hour and a half. And after, an hour or so, little Tad came toddling into the study, and he said, "Daddy, Daddy." And I said, "What?" And he said, "I have two heads." And I said, "What?" And he said, "I have two heads." And I said, "What?" And he said, "You asked why I did it, and it's because I have two heads. One head said, 'Daddy's not going to like this.' And the other head said, 'This is going to be fun.'" Well, immediately I had been conceiving of this, he was then 5 years old. I thought I was bringing up a serial killer or a juvenile delinquent. I imagined him at Huntsville, getting executed by Governor Perry. And the respect I suddenly had for the sophistication of this two-headed thought really struck me. There's a tradition in our house that I'm a writer, and so not only do I tell stories to my kids, from books and so on, and Thumbelina or Hansel and Gretel, but on occasion, pretty much every night, I make up my own stories. And that night, as I lay in the dark, flanked by Timmy on one side and Tad on the other, I began a story by saying, "Once upon a time, I knew somebody with two heads. And in the dark, Timmy sat up and said, you're kidding. I mean, are you really? And I said, yeah, really. And Tad sat up on the other side and said, what was his name? And I said, his name was Daddy. Both kids kind of leaned in simultaneously, kind of looking at my neck, looking for the stump of that extra head. Well, over the course of the next, I don't know, 20 minutes, 25 minutes, I began telling them a kind of cleaned up, Ajaxed, you know, sanitized version of a chapter in one of my books. The book is The Things They Carried, and the chapter is a chapter called On the Rainy River. It's the story of the summer I became a soldier, in the summer of 1968, the summer I was drafted. I explained to these two kids that that summer, before going to the war, before even being in the Army, was in many, many ways much more problematical and much more personally traumatic than anything that happened to me in Vietnam itself. I was in control. I could say yes. I could say no. I could head for Canada. I could head for jail. Or I could head for a war. I told them I was 21 years old, and I was opposed to the war in Vietnam. It seemed to me then as a kid, if that's the appropriate word for a 21-year-old, but it seems to me now as a 66-year-old, that you don't go off killing people unless you're fairly sure it's the right thing to do. I told them that, you know, the best one could say about Vietnam was that certain blood was being shed for uncertain reasons. The bodies were for sure. The maimed were for sure. The widows were for sure. The orphans were for sure. The Gold Star mothers were for sure. Nobody disputed it on any side politically. But as anyone who lived through that war knows, the reasons for the war were at best suspect. Hawks at the throats of doves, smart people not able to make their minds up about the rectitude of the war, people at Congress divided, the nation divided, my own family divided. What do you do if you're 21 years old and you're told to go kill and perhaps die in a war that you don't believe in and that the country doesn't seem to believe in, at least in terms of consensus? Well, by this time, Timmy and Tad are asleep. And there I am, lying in the dark, flanked by these two precious little boys, telling myself for the upzillionth time the story of that summer of 68, in which it felt as if I were bearing two heads. One of these heads, you know, situated, say, over here, was a lover of my country, a believer in sacrifice for country. My dad had been a sailor during World War II off of Iwo Jima and Okinawa. My mom had been in the Waves, adjunct of the Navy back then. In fact, they had met in Norfolk, Virginia during the war. In a way, I was a child of war. On the other hand, there was another head up here, believing in all the same virtues of service to country and loving America, but also a head that wanted nothing to do with the Vietnam War, certainly not to kill people, and even more certainly not to die. I was 21 years old. I was terrified. And through the summer of 1968, those two heads endlessly confronted each other, challenging and mocking and debating and taunting and cussing, invoking God and the names of LBJ and Richard Nixon and Jane Fonda and Abby Hoffman and Patrick Henry and Daffy Duck. A whole litany of history going through my head. Now and then, these two heads would speak rationally to each other in the Minnesota dark as I tried to decide, should I go to this war or not? Other times, the two heads would be seeming to scream the most outrageous obscenities at each other, screaming the black and white kind of platitudes that were being screamed all across this republic of ours through the hot summer of 1968. I was not now telling the story to Timmy and Tad, but I was telling it to myself, as I will tell it again tonight when I go to bed at the Marriott, as I will tell it tomorrow night and the night thereafter, until probably the day I die. Now and then, one of these heads might score a sterile rhetorical victory. And at other times, the other head will win the day. Sometimes one head might say to the other, "What a coward you were for going to that war. You couldn't say no because you were too embarrassed to utter that word. Embarrassed in hometown, small town America. Embarrassed to hear your girlfriend utter that word. Family." And then the other head will say, "Give me a break. You did what your country asked you to do." And the other head will chuckle and say, "All right. And what if my country asked me to blow up Toronto tomorrow? Do I just do it? Is that what we mean by patriotism? Anything? Automatic? Sacrifice your integrity and your conscience?" And the other head would say very sternly, "Come on. You live in a great and good nation, a country that would never issue such an order. Don't be ridiculous." And the other head will say, "Ah, well, what about My Lai? What about the American Indian? What about weapons of mass destruction that did not exist? What about robber barons in pinstripes? What about McCarthyism? What about Hollywood blacklists?" And the other head will say, "Come on, everybody makes mistakes." And the other head will say, "Exactly my point. Everybody makes mistakes." And finally, one of these two heads will say, "Come on, let's go to sleep." And at 2 or 3 in the morning, I'll go off until the next night when these two heads begin talking to one another once again. Well, it strikes me now on this wonderful occasion, an occasion that I would never have dreamed of 40 years ago, as I lay at the bottom of an irrigation ditch in Vietnam, listening to men die all around me, screaming the word "Mom" and "Dad" and "Mommy" and "Mama," and listening to the voices of the dying Vietnamese all around me as well. It strikes me on this occasion that it's important to give a bow to two-headedness, to the complications and ambiguities of this world that have to do with what Mr. Holbrooke was all about as a diplomat and what I think we are honoring here. We're honoring, in a way, a desire for common sense, to pay attention to those important questions of what we die for and what we kill for, if anything, and to find ways to avoid the dying for and the killing for, if at all possible. Part of being an adult, part of being human, I think, as opposed to being... say a chipmunk, is that at certain points in our lives, we will all carry upon our heads 2 or more heads. It can be a curse. It can lead to wee-hour second-guessing, as it has for me over the last 4 decades, endless speculation about what could have been or what should have been. You in this audience may well find yourself now and then doing exactly what I do every night, lying in those beds, revisiting through a story or through memory a moral choice you made or failed to make or would make differently. Two heads can be a problem, but two heads can also be the sign of an open mind, of a mind attuned to the world's pesky ambiguities and complexities and mysteries and uncertainties, of a person sophisticated enough to understand that knowledge can be imperfect and that one's own judgment may be dead wrong or may evolve or refine itself. To carry through two heads through life, however burdensome, however dispiriting, may help to avoid the soul-killing, people-killing mistakes of absolutism. Muhammad Atta, the hijacker and final pilot of one of those airliners that struck the World Trade Center on September 11th, 2001, had but one head, a bonehead at that, an absolutist of the most consummate and deadly sort. Atta thought he knew the final and definitive truth of things, a truth worth killing for and a truth worth dying for. Let us not, let me not, and you not commit the same one-headed sin of vanity and complacency and self-righteousness and demagoguery and fanaticism and zealotry and simple-minded black and white, you're right and I'm wrong, absolutism. After the events of recent years, I have come to fear that our own nation, as much as any other nation, is endangered by such slick, self-centered, absolutist rhetoric that erases our own national shortcomings, erases our own ethical and moral failures, torture, for example, in favor of a vision of America as somehow exceptional and beyond the norm. It is a great and good nation, and we can recognize that while also looking bluntly and directly at the facts of the world we live in. I conclude by coming back to that irrigation ditch that I mentioned to you a few moments ago. The month was July, the year was 1969. I was then had a rank of a Spec 4. Our company had been operating near where the My Lai massacre had taken place. It hadn't yet been exposed. No one knew about it except those who did it. And, of course, the Vietnamese lived through it. And in a ditch not far from where that massacre happened, about a year prior to my arriving in Vietnam, our company had been pinned down by heavy machine gun and mortar fire, and we'd taken refuge, many of us, not all of us, in a ditch that was, I suppose, thigh deep or knee deep, depending on where you were in the ditch, in slime, a mix of paddy water and algae and leeches and human waste. The stink was unbelievable. And in my dreams and in my waking hours as well, I can still hear the voices of those people, not just dying, but badly wounded, and the voices of the Vietnamese too. And at the bottom of that ditch, somehow, as this half-hour firefight went on, I became a writer. It wasn't said in that language, I'm going to write. It was more a feeling of somehow, some way, I'll bear witness to this. I'll testify. I will not stay silent. I will not stay silent after all the silence that I had exercised in going to this war, the silences that I had, to my great discredit, had committed As I watched evil after evil and sin after sin being perpetrated, I would not stay quiet. For 40 years, I haven't shut up, and I will not. Thank you so much to Dayton, and thank you so much for an award that means the world to me. Good night.
Tim O'Brien, recipient of the 2012 Richard C. Holbrook Distinguished Achievement Award. You've been listening to a special presentation of the 2012 Dayton Literary Peace Prize Awards Ceremony. Special thanks to Sharon Rabb, Jenny Chang, and Patrick Kowalczyk. For more information on the Dayton Literary Peace Prize, including past winners and events throughout the year, visit daytonliterarypeaceprize.org. For 91.3 WYSO, I'm Juliet Frumholt. To hear an archived version of this program, visit us online at wyso.org. Thank you.